I call this meeting of the Board of Supervisors to order. Let us begin with the Pledge of Allegiance and a moment of silence. Would all please stand?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you very much. Okay, now we will look at the agenda. Is everyone okay with the agenda?
One addition.
With the addition of Tyler.
Yeah, we've got an extra Eagle Scout resolution that Mr. Sheridan has in front of him. I've got it linked up to pull up on the screen, but it just came in, so it wasn't on the agenda. But his induction ceremony is this weekend, so we'd like to be able to put that on new business, and I'll be able to pull it up and you'll be able to see the resolution when we get to that.
Okay. Is everyone okay with the agenda with the new addition?
I move to accept the agenda as stated with the correction for the Eagle Scout.
Motion's been made by Mr. Weaver, seconded by Ms. Booker. All in favor?
Aye.
Chair votes aye. 5-0. Now we will move on to the County Administrator's report.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the board. Number of items to cover. Hands-on Flavanna Community Cleanup Day was on the 22nd. I think it was the 22nd, wasn't it? Yeah, Friday, April 22nd. You could see some of the folks out there working, but it was really a great day by all accounts. There were, you know, many people that participated. They collected 80 bags of trash along Route 15. They did some mulching at the Carysbrook Playground, mulched the playground, the Pleasant Grove Park Playground, overseeded, put straw down, and picked up trash along the Americans with Disabilities, the disabled handicap access trail at Pleasant Grove. The Carpentry Club at the high school did a whole bunch of work and had a really good time, I think, doing it, but did a really good work on cleaning up areas that day and disassembling an old shed. And then we really appreciate Will Shaw and Aaron Spitzer's help in coordinating all this effort, and the rest of the Public Works team that helped make this a big success. It really was, and hope to be able to do these again and get people involved in a pretty simple, easy, quick way. So the Farm Museum, I want to just let you know, you've got a copy of this in front of you. I think I gave you one. There's a picture of the Farm Museum on, or maybe I didn't, I'm sorry, I've got them here. I'll pass them out to you. This, I wanted to show this because this, the first time I saw this a couple days ago, it just looked a little more expansive than I'd been hearing and kind of thought. And that Farm Museum looks kind of like the Taj Mahal Farm Museum. I don't know where the plans are for that. We're still working on engaging an architect to do a design and things, but I just wanted you to be aware that there may be some divergence in opinion on the scope of this project, so we have to kind of watch that carefully because there'll be a downstream tail to a big building and what is in that building and the facilities. This may be just for example sake, but once an example is shown to the public, people start getting expectations, and there's some work involved in.
So you don't have any idea what square footage is or anything now? It's
just the square footage we've been talking about was more like 30 by 40.
Right.
It wasn't huge, but this is.
Yeah, a lot more than that.
A lot bigger.
Yes.
And if you do cubic feet, this is about the size of. It's big.
Yeah.
But it, again, it may be a mock-up because I had just seen it for the first time the other day. I just wanted to make sure you were aware of it. So if you're at Pleasant Grove on Saturday and you see the Farm Museum displays and them soliciting funds to raise for that project, that's the part of the posters that are going to be displayed. So.
Yeah, I've seen something like that someplace else.
They showed us a picture. The drawing that Mr. Moss brought to us, was that model?
It was similar.
It wasn't quite that
elevation. It was a little different elevation. It was similar style.
I remember it had the extra on top. And it was
right.
The pricing of it maybe will be important. Just a reminder that you've got the two programs to recognize employees and community members. We've printed a bunch of these cards, and you've got some in front of you there that you can use for. There's two different cards I think you've got there. We gave you a little stack of the Community Service Awards one. It's the one that's green on front and blue on the back. One is for employee recognition. One is for Community Service Awards. You can hand it out to neighbors, or somebody says something good about, you know, employee, or gosh, you know, Mrs. Jones sure did great on volunteering for that effort. This is how they can recognize in our community. It's all online. Just click on the links on our website. But these are just little advertising cards, so we'll have them at all our events and meetings and things like that. And then, as I showed you before, those links are live on our website. The spotlight on business for this week, we're talking about the Community Business Forum. You've gotten the invite for that, and you've got some cards there in front of you that can be used to hand out to businesses if you stop someplace. Invite them to the Community Business Forum on May 19th. It's at 5:30 in the evening at St. Peter and Paul Catholic Church at their Parish Center, and we'll have some guest speakers. We'll preview the results of the Business Climate Survey, and then work on the Community Business Support Action Plan. And that's what's intended for that night, in partnership with the Economic Development Authority and the Chamber of Commerce. And then I'd like to welcome aboard our new building official, Mr. Florin Mulgalvin, who's a Savannah resident, again working. Florin comes to us with excellent experience and incredible credentials, and is already out there working hard since Mr. Lester retired last Friday. He's doing it on his own. So he's running pretty quickly to try to keep up on all the inspections. But we really appreciate him being on board and bringing his talents to the Fluvanna County staff. I wanted to ask the board about building fees, ENS fees, planning fees for county projects. On your agenda tonight, on the consent agenda, is a waiver of fees to build the tower at the sheriff's office, although actually we've modified that a little bit. But it seems that I've been doing this a lot for the last few years, bringing a county project to you and requesting a waiver of fees for that. And I'm not sure why we're processing that paperwork. We still have to fill out the permits. We still have to fill out all the necessary paperwork, because we have to follow those steps. But paying ourselves a fee just doesn't make much sense to me. So I'd like to head forward towards a draft ordinance change to bring to you. And then if you all think that's reasonable, appropriate, then we would get a public hearing scheduled to adopt that. You'll still have all the necessary safety protections in place as far as ENS reviews and building permits and site designs and things like that, but we wouldn't be writing a check to pay ourselves for one of our own projects.
I think that's what we need.
Now, in just for the public interest, if it's a project for a for-profit enterprise, normally that we don't do any waivers, and those when people just pay those fees. Occasionally, I think in the past, a nonprofit that serves Savannah County has come and request a waiver on a project, and I think those again could just still be handled on a case-by-case basis rather than by ordinance. But for county projects that we're building, I think we probably ought to put that to rest. So we'll bring you a draft sample and see how it works out. The speed study on the 53 portion that was asked a while back, from Raritan Lake Road to the roundabout. So right there at the curve at Raritan Lake Road, you go past Cunningham Church, Cunningham Market, and down to the roundabout. That goes back up to 55. That's now going to be 45. They approved that. And so from east of Pleasant Grove Park on 53, all the way past the high school, past Raritan Lake Road, Cunningham Church, to the traffic circle, will be 45 that entire length. Makes a heck of a lot more sense. I drive that, several times every single day, and it's a bad kind of curvy stretch anyway, with that Raritan Lake Road a lot of cars coming in and out of there. But being 45 from the traffic circle all the way to past the high school just makes a lot more sense, and VDOT has agreed to that.
There's a bad view too when you come out from the Raritan Road on to 53.
Oh, absolutely.
It's a dip there, and you can't hardly see down in there.
And absolutely. And if you're coming west on 53, you can see the Raritan Lake Road traffic, but you can't see what's coming over that hill.
That's what I'm talking about.
That hill really needs to be cut down.
It does.
I can ask them about it, but VDOT has looked at that whole stretch multiple times, and this one wasn't even supported by the traffic studies, but they did it because it's such a short section, because we bugged them a lot on it, and also because it makes it more contiguous from the traffic circle to the high school. But the speed study that they did not support the change either. So
But that's especially bad when you're pulling out onto 53 to your left, because they're down in that dip.
Right.
You pull right out in front of them.
Yeah, I don't disagree. The only time it's actually a little safer is at night, because you can see headlights coming.
Yes.
But daytime, it's really hard.
And even when you're turning onto Rogan Lake off of 53.
Yeah, yeah.
If you're headed west,
left,
if you're
well,
headed
you better hope you're on the passenger side of the car. So, indeed. So we'll continue to talk to VDOT about it and see if there's any requirement to cut down that. I just don't know if too many...
Well, you could ask. It's not going to hurt to ask. Or
don't know too many accidents that have been reported there, even though it seems like it's an accident waiting to happen.
Everybody's aware of it.
You may have seen in the newspaper and on the TV news and then on online multiple places, Dominion has finished the first testing of the dewatering, the water that comes out of it when it's treated before it goes into the James. They finished the testing of that first batch. And here's the testing results on their website. And this has been on the TV news and in the papers as well. But there's the testing results of the first one. You can see green checks all the way down. These are the limits, the permissible limits, and these are the actual amounts. So, for instance, less than 5 micrograms, but the limit is 2,100 micrograms. Less than 5 micrograms, the limit is 23 micrograms. So in every category, at least so far, with the stringent process they've put in place, they've exceeded they've been well below the permitted limits for discharge, and I don't think any of them are even really close. So
they're trying to get down to where we were talking about.
Yeah, but Dominion had committed to that above what DEQ had required, and so these reports will be online, and they were reported in the news stations in Charlottesville. I've seen them on Facebook already, and then of course linked up here. So people can see
how
that.
How often will they perform? How often?
I think they're weekly until the process is done. I think the process is 18 months or 2 years was the cycle, but it's done weekly.
Because I gather the heavier concentrations will be closer to the bottom.
Yeah, although the longer it settles, the more they'll settle too. So as they're skimming off the top, hopefully it won't be churning up the bottom. I'm sure they've got measures in place to do that, but that's what these reports are meant to show, that they're well below the legal limits.
And they're done by an outside firm.
An outside firm, good. The testing, yes. Right. Yeah, the plant itself and the process, Dominion put in place, but the outside firm does do that testing. So. Mm-hmm. That's good news for our citizens. Just a reminder, the legislature passed that new proffers bill this year, and it substantially ramps back on the more expansive types of proffer policies that some counties have had. And so just really need to make sure you remember that they need to be voluntary, and they can't be, we have to be careful with the documentation to make sure that it doesn't look like we're forcing the issue and making a developer put a specific proffer in. Proffers are voluntary, and many developers do that because they know that what they do will have an impact on the community from other resource needs, and to sell their product, to sell their development, to sell their thing, they're often willing to do that. But you can't be putting proffers in place that make it mandatory for X, Y, or Z. Albemarle, I think, is one of the ones that's kind of taking the lead, kind of railing back against this, but that's what the law says for now. So
is there documentation that's available to the county that would fall in line with what is the guidance in terms of the state and the ordinance?
Well, the statute's pretty detailed. Mm-hmm. And what it does is you can't just proffer X dollars for parks. just make that up. You have to have specific projects, specific amounts, and you have to have real clear, it has to be real clear that this is truly voluntary.
And that it ties to the specific,
right, and it's got to be
extra need that's
yeah, it's got to be in the CIP or the comprehensive plan. It's detailed like that. It's very detailed. Mm-hmm. And it is, I've been expecting something like this, mm-hmm. and I think I've told you that before.
Right.
This idea of a proffer policy where every single family dwelling requires $12,000 contribution to the county. I think that's completely off the table. Mm-hmm. Albemarle wrote a sort of beseeching letter to the governor, asking him to veto this bill or to amend it, and he it didn't it none of it was approved. I'm not surprised at this at all. I don't understand why it's being done this way. For the proffers are one thing, because you know there are lots of proffers you can use, but cash proffers are a different issue. And I don't know why the General Assembly doesn't just pass enabling legislation to have some sort of development tax. You know, call it whatever you want to, but you know, if you're costing us $3,000 for on average for a school per dwelling unit, whatever it is, I mean, just pick a number, that you simply pay it like you would pay a building permit fee. The General Assembly hasn't done that, and they've gone through this, I won't call it a charade, but they've gone through this process where proffers were really very limited initially, and they kept getting, I think some of the counties got greedy on the enabling legislation, and the General Assembly just cut it off. But this is very serious, because it does have adverse consequences if you violate this statute. And I believe there's a presumption that if there's a proffer made and the application is denied, there's a presumption that it was denied because of the proffer. And that really, really makes a difference, because that changes the burden of proof and really encourages, let's say it will encourage the localities to be more analytical about the way they apply the law in this case, in this issue. And it'll encourage the developers to be more specific, but also to challenge denials that are based on this. So I can't say I'm surprised by this. It won't be a problem for us, because we don't have this, you know, this table of charges. We just need to be more. We need to be specific, careful, and specific about how, if we accept a cash proffer, tying it back to the appropriate standards.
We have to be careful for the board and the planning commission not to grill the developer on what's the proffer offer. What are you going to give us?
Yeah, I'd have voted for this, except for the fact that, you know, this is costing us $12,000 per student, and you only offered $8,000. Yeah. You know, please don't say that, because that would pretty clearly violate the statute.
So, in light of that, is the idea that we would not have a proffer policy? Is that basically
no proffer guidance? No proffer policy.
Guidance.
We don't create proffer policies.
Let's make clear what we're talking about. There's nothing wrong with the county accepting voluntary proffers. What's wrong with this, I think the thing that triggered this statute was these tables, you know, where you walk in and say, I want a rezoning for a, you know, an apartment building, whatever mm-hmm. it might be. And the first thing they do in the planning department is hand you a sheet that says, okay, for each apartment unit, it's going to cost you, you know, $8,000 or whatever it is. I think that's a slam dunk loser. And I think that's really the kind of thing that was aimed at in this project. It also needs to be tied proffers that offer either money or money's worth are required to be more nearly tied directly to the project. So you can't, and I'm, you know, I don't want to be too specific about this, but the idea is you can't just say, well, you know, we'll give you a school site somewhere in the county. Now if you say we'll give you a school site here because, you know, next to our project, because we're going to be generating X number of children, and it's proportionate for us to solve that problem, I think something like that would be okay. But that's the kind of care that you'd have to have when these things come in to ensure that you're not transgressing this statute.
So all right. Still not quite sure whether we have a guidance policy or how do we describe it? In other words, we're still looking for some.
Well, what we've done
feedback
is
from the planning
commission.
What we've done historically is to figure based on the comprehensive plan and based on standard figures. The kind of things that are public costs. So that if you have 200, you look at the project and it's going to generate 200 public school students, you can calculate what a public school student costs. You could probably do that. And we've done that. We've done that kind of thing.
But that doesn't mean they're going to profit.
Because I got the impression that you're saying you could not do percent.
No. He's saying, here's what it costs us for this kind of stuff. And you have those numbers available for review. Or someone says, hey, we might be interested in proffering something. What kind of profit do you want? Well, we're not asking for a specific profit. We just know that these kinds of development cost us this thing, or we have these kinds of needs that support this kind of work. You cannot say, it costs us $3,000 per student, so we need, $3,000 per, $6,000 per household, because there's an average of 2.41, kids or whatever.
Well, the other thing is, developer comes in and says, I want to rezone from A1 to R3 or R2. And you don't want the staffs having the first words out of their mouth being, well, that's fine, you're going to need to proffer some cash. They say that, I think that's a clear violation of the statute.
Sure.
So I don't consider this to be a major problem for us. I do consider it to be a major problem for places like Albemarle that have been really leaning on this, on these, what I'll call standard fees, because that's really what they are. You can call it profits if you want, but that's really what they are. And they're substantial. They're five figures per dwelling unit in a lot of cases.
That was like 20,000 or something.
Something like that. I don't remember the exact figure, but this is, you have 100 units of that.
That's
a lot.
Yeah, and that's going to certainly impact their budgeting.
Well, it impacts all the people that are buying those units then too, because
sure,
the cost is just passed on to the citizens that are getting that.
Well, I think
now, they may get passed on in another way through taxes when taxes have to go to build a new school.
Right.
But then it's spread over the entire locality. But there's just no good way to expect to be getting a certain amount from developers for proffers. So we'll have some guidelines after it comes through the Planning Commission, hopefully sooner rather than later. It's already been later. But they won't be proper policies. So.
All right, Mr. Nichols, anything else?
Yep, bunch more stuff. Sorry. We're working on the potential update for our county website. We've been on this site for 4 years, and it's becoming a little more difficult to maintain. It's a Joomla-based system, and Joomla, we really did it on Joomla because Jonathan McMahon had some skills and knowledge in Joomla, but we need something that's a little bit easier to load, easier to maintain the documents, and looks a little bit more updated and professional, just because nothing stays the same in the web world, electronic world, and we've got 4 years of old behind us, and we need to do some updates. One of the things we want to do is dramatically increase the economic development, the business page and a tourism page. So Jason Smith has already worked on developing those things, but we need to be able to get this on a platform. We've had one company come in, or two companies come in already and talk to us. We'll have several others probably coming in, but this is probably a $25,000 to $30,000 cost to rebuild the site, reload it in a new scheme, get the economic development and tourism items up, and then probably $3,000 to $4,000 a year maintenance fees that you normally do with a company to support that. If we stay on our Joomla platform, then we're going to have to hire a firm to do the Joomla maintenance of it, because we don't have any subject matter experts on board to do that. And if we send a staff member to get Joomla training, then you're always trying to play catch up on, okay, what if that staff member leaves? Now you got to send another staff member. Joomla is not the platform we want to remain, but it was a good transition from the old site we had to now. So what we're looking for is just board's feedback on, we're going to be getting proposals from a variety, but we'll be coming back to you. Some of the money we've got in an existing budget, we'll identify that and lay it out, but some of the money we may need additional funding in the coming fiscal year
to be able to do the update.
So it wasn't in the budget?
It wasn't. We've been working on this for quite some time, and we didn't budget it specifically just because we didn't know where it was going to head or what the costs were going to be, and so it may take a year transition to do that. But we also may have the budget, a large part of that budget already built into the IT budget. We just have to realign some of the dollars that are there. We already had dollars in there for web maintenance, but it's not enough to redesign the website. The web maintenance things would be. But I just don't have staff that can maintain our site. We can load stuff in the old frame, but I can't do any substantial updates to it. And one of the ways we live and breathe with information nowadays is through the web. Plus, our website is not optimized for tablet or for phone. And go find somebody that is not walking around with a phone in their hand today, and it will be the rare exception. But everything based on tablet and phone, you can't use just a standard website if you expect to have a decent user experience and use it on there and use it quickly. The other thing is we had a speed run done on our website just on the standard load to get to a page, and compared to what the norm should be, and it was exponentially different, like, you know, 100 score versus it should have been a 4 or something like that. So we tested a variety of different pages. So there's a lot of inefficiencies built into the structure of our Joomla-based website, but we don't have the expertise to convert that over. But it's part of the way we do business in today's world.
Is there a particular platform that you're looking at?
Expression Engine is the one, Joomla Expression Engine, and there was one more, I don't remember the other name, but those are the kind of the three platforms that are typical that are being used a lot now. There's a couple others that are in vogue depending on who the developer is, but Joomla and Expression Engine and
WordPress.
WordPress, yes. Although WordPress is much more focused on like small nonprofits and local organizations rather than big company websites or county websites, because it has a little less functionality than most of the others. And that's what the offerer said when they came through, because they offered WordPress, Joomla, Expression Engine.
.NET Nuke might be another one.
Is it
.NET Nuke?
Drupal.
Yeah.
Drupal was the other one. So, yeah. But anyway, so we're looking, and we'll come back to you with more information.
Are there any hosting providers that focus specifically on county sites?
There are not here specifically in the area. Some of the companies we've already talked to have county websites that they manage or maintain. One of them just did an update, new website for Greene County, for instance. But there's not a lot of them around Central Virginia that focus on government websites solely. This one company, just as an example, InMerge Technologies from the Valley, has about 6 or 8 different government customers they do websites for, but we want, and they seem spectacularly good and seem like they'd meet all our needs, but I want to look a little bit and see what else is out there. What I don't want to do is I don't really want to stay on the Joomla platform unless we've got a management company that lives and breathes Joomla, so that we can, if we need a structural change, it's just one email, and in 2 or 3 days it's done and up and loaded, and you don't have to fiddle with it. Loading content is not the problem, but our site has 504 pages of content or 554 pages of content or something like that. But the problem is a lot of the content's old and needs to be pulled down. But trying to figure out the mapping system in a Joomla system that's been used for 4 years that hasn't been on the backside maintained well. Plus, our system, when Mr. McMahon built it, he's done a lot of custom tailoring. And so if we make a change to it, unless you know where every one of those custom tailoring things are, it's not fun. Yeah. So what we really need is a fresh look, simpler, and someone who knows it inside out, that we don't have to waste too much staff time on trying to do to add the buttons, the ones I showed you a couple weeks ago, the employee recognition buttons and the community service award buttons. You'd think that'd be snap easy, and the connections would be easy. On the Joomla side, it's not in the current structure. But it is easy if you've got the right platform framework. So that's what we're working on, and hope to show you some other numbers and figures and site samples in the future. But we really have to make it usable for mobile devices nowadays. It's funny because all the meetings I have, I'll bet 5 or 6 times a week, I'm in a meeting or at a function or at out in town someplace, and somebody will ask a question, and I just reach over and pull my phone up, my iPad, pull up our county website. Yeah, just hit this button right there. But the problem is the load time. You want to be pretty fast on this stuff, and you want it to be very user-friendly for this kind of device. But we use it all the time. So, and we track all our hits on our website, too, so we know how much traffic we have, and it's substantial. We run Google Analytics on our quick links. And then just coming up, you've got 3 regular meetings the rest of this month, and then next month, just your regular May 18th meeting. We've got 1 or 2 public hearings that night. Kelly, do you know? On May 18th, public hearings? One public hearing on the 18th, and then your regular meetings on June 1st and June 15th. And I don't have any work sessions planned or scheduled, so if you all think of something on a specific work session topic, let us know. We're going to need some things on water and sewer systems development and planning overlays and zoning overlays and Zion Crossroads development, but that'll be sometime probably in later in our calendar. Any questions I can answer for the board? Two other things. I gave you this list. It's just kind of a quick spreadsheet list. This is a list of ongoing and current topics and programs and processes and projects that staff's working on. Look down through it. There's a litany of things there. Way too much, seems like some days, but a lot of good projects cooking. They're prioritized by us in current and the more urgent ones, and then ones in the next 6 months and over the next year and then the coming years. But that's just an updated list for you all. And then I don't think I forwarded this to you, but we got an email, I got an email and then a letter from a citizen whose family owns the old fire tower on Route 6 and wanted to know why we were going to build the cell tower at the landfill rather than putting it on his fire tower. And I already responded to him, and they were appreciative and stuff. That tower is way, way, way too small for the weight and the height we need for the E911. I explained all that to him and showed him the different permutations and why it wouldn't necessarily work, but that I would keep his fire tower in mind, because every time I've noticed it, I've wondered why, you know, was it still belonging to the fire service? It doesn't. It's privately owned. The commercial tower antennas they had on there are no longer operative, but there's no reason why some commercial carriers may not want to put something on. So as we hear those things, we'll let them know about that possibility. But his location, even though it's pretty close to the landfill, and his height don't meet anywhere near the requirement.
What is the height of that?
The one at the landfill will be 300.
No, not that one, the other one.
Oh,
the tower.
It's, I think it's just 100 or what, between 90 and 110.
Mm-hmm.
That's just a guess.
90 feet, yeah. He said the site, he was talking about one where you could use this to communicate to another tower in Dillon. Well, the one, if his fire tower communicated with the tower in Dillon, the tower in Dillon must have been pretty darn high. But for our purposes,
it's very large. It's not just a.
Uh huh.
I just happen to know that one. It's a big major
and
site.
We're putting a 250 at the landfill, show. So the 250 at the landfill, though, has got to be able to see from there to the other towers it connects to, but also down into the James River Basin to be down in the Scottsville area. That's part of the reason we need a much higher
sure,
tower.
Sure, need one in there.
Yeah. So anyway, I'm just letting you know because it's a good question from a citizen. I
sure
answered
is.
It and responded
and
back to him.
We surely appreciate the Christmas decorations he put on.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, between that one and Papa Jim's house on
and the one
on
down at
South Boston
Imogene,
where he put the trees.
Imogene Johnson's.
Yes, and
that
one too.
Over there on Long Acre.
We have some good ones there.
Alrighty.
Anyway, any questions I can answer for the board?
No. Okay, we'll move forward. Board of Supervisors updates. Mr. O'Brien?
Oh, it's a Planning Commission meeting and nothing spectacular to report there. It's a pretty standard meeting.
Okay.
TJPDC tomorrow and Piedmont Workforce Network Council. That's it for right now.
Ms. Booker?
I went to the chair and mayor's meeting, and
thank you.
You're welcome. But I had my notes, and I didn't bring them with me, and I can't remember everything, but I know that my county administrator will. What was the
You would think that, I would be able to do that, but it's buried somewhere on my desk, and there wasn't anything that jumped on that. I need action item now, but it was a lot of good discussion. Right. We do have some broadband discussions coming up with TJPDC. Right. They've got a kind of a community forum that I'll be going to, and there were a couple of issues, but they weren't hot immediate action items. So,
right.
Sorry.
And we did meet the new mayor.
Yeah, Mayor Signer.
Yeah. Yeah, and what I felt was that PDC and Chip is just really enthusiastic about the role that Thomas Jefferson have been taking part of, and they're really jumping in, trying to help the county, I think, more and be more of a partner. So I said, I think that Mr. Boyd Chip is really, they've been, like he said, he's being more aggressive, and they're really trying to do what they're supposed to be doing.
He's definitely being more aggressive.
Stepping in, and I don't know how far it'll go, but it's just a good, comfortable feeling to me that I...
Well, it's nice to have somebody that was so willing to engage and interact.
Right.
Because for me, with my counterparts, all the city manager and all the county administrators, it's really our links are really important, mm-hmm. but it's also important with our elected officials, and that means right. an important one for us.
Yeah.
So it was nice to see yeah. everybody engaged.
You know, the other thing that he talked about is these regional economic development, that the regions are going to be pretty large. What is it, 8 regions in this state?
Probably 9 regions, but our region is likely set already as Region 9 and Region 10 mm-hmm. for the planning districts.
Right.
And so, and we've got a pretty good relationship with the other planning district already, and the Thomas Jefferson Planning District Commission and the Central Virginia Partnership for Economic Development have been working hard on the structure and the framework for that, so that we can get in on the ground floor mm-hmm. of the Go Virginia program. There's several sets of money approved for that over the biennium, some on the front end for administration and setup, some for that will be allocated based on population, and some will be allocated competitively. I think $12 million based on population and $14 million or $18 million over the biennium for based on competitive projects. And it could be something like a shared business park. It could be a infrastructure project that serves more people. It could be, you know, a new investment project of some type where you're bringing a Fortune 500 company in, or an Amazon.com warehouse, or things like that.
Right.
But it's really open to almost any kind of ideas, as long as they're more than one player, there's some collaboration involved, and there's a substantive job/economic development impact. So.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Ms. Eager.
I enjoyed sitting on the audit committee. Thank you very much to the staff.
All right, Mr. Weaver,
no.
Nothing?
No.
And we haven't had any meetings with the finance committee, so we can move forward to the first round of public comments. Having said that, I ask that anyone wishing to speak to the board come to the podium. Please state your name and address. You will have 5 minutes. Please keep your comments to the point, and is there anyone wishing to speak to the board?
Good afternoon. Denise Bonds. I'm the director of the health district, but I'm actually here today speaking on behalf of a consortium of local organizations that have been working over the past 9 months or so on our third annual community health assessment. Group has been spending the last 9 months reviewing existing data in the community, and we're about to launch into our survey of the residents of Fluvanna and the other counties and areas within the Thomas Jefferson Health District to determine what they believe are the strengths and areas that need improvement. We will be actually at the Farm Day this Saturday, so you'll see us there if you're there, asking residents to fill out our three-question survey. We'll also be at the Wellness Fair and at the Farmers Market in Palmyra. The survey will be available online as well, and we'll send the link to Mr. Nichols, and he can feel free to distribute it to whomever he thinks is appropriate. Everybody, we want everyone's opinion on what they think is important about Fluvanna. You should feel free to take the survey yourself, and then once we have the survey results, we'll be looking at what the individuals think and the existing data, and working within the consortium of local agencies to come up with a health improvement plan. And one of us will be back to present that to you sometime in the fall. I'd be happy to answer any questions. I did bring a copy of the survey. It's just three questions: where you live, what makes your community a healthy place to live, and what you would like to improve in your community. So I'll leave these here for you.
Thank you so very much. Frisbee golf. Appreciate that. No, ma'am. He just
okay.
Did he play frisbee golf?
I did.
Yeah, he got it in there. You knew he was gonna get it in there somewhere. All righty. Is there anyone else?
If you want to switch on the speak, on frisbee golf.
No one else willing to speak. I will now close the first round of public comments.
I'd like to make a comment, Mrs. Dr. Bonds. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The Interagency Council meets tomorrow. We meet every Thursday after the board meeting.
Yes.
And we have Elizabeth and young people come and share the information with us. And Bertha Armstrong and myself, we go to the big, big meeting with all the other counties.
That's right.
And I'm really anxious to know how we're going to come out this when you all make the report.
Mm-hmm.
And I certainly would like to have us consider some action items on how we're going to help in those concerns. Obesity was one. One was infant deaths, basic, some African-American babies. There was one other that...
From the last?
Yeah, from the last one.
Obesity, pregnancy outcomes,
right.
Particularly the disparity in pregnancy outcomes. Tobacco use,
yes.
And
right.
Actually mental health and
right.
substance
and the mental
use.
Mental health issue, which is most of the counties had
right.
an issue with mental health.
Yes.
But just, and we will, in your report, we will see how we have grown. If we haven't,
yes,
then we need to start thinking about what are some things we can do to correct those. I just don't want to see a report and we get it and we don't do anything about it. I mean, I'm not talking about you.
No.
I'm talking about Fluvanna County.
Right. No, and
we don't address it and make sure that improvements are made. Otherwise, there's no need to make a study. No need to be going to all these meetings. But
right. Our plan at this point in time, so we've worked very hard to make sure that we've gotten the most local data that we can.
Right.
To review so far, and sometimes that's difficult because mm-hmm. of the surveys and the limitations
right.
on what they can report out on, depending on sample size. What we have done in the past is once the issues have been identified and agreed upon, consortiums of agencies in the area have come together to develop a plan
mm-hmm.
to work on. The last time around, those consortiums were district-wide.
Mm-hmm.
This time, we're very committed to having local consortiums to deal with your particular concerns within Fluvanna County. This requires a huge amount of work on everybody's part, and so to be successful, we'll need all of the local agencies to come together and really participate, because this is, while the health department is serving as a facilitator, this is not our community health assessment plan. We are only facilitating this. This really is owned by the community, and anything that comes out of it has to be driven by the community.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's a great opportunity to really focus on what the citizens of Fluvanna think are important and what they would like to accomplish over the next few years.
Mm-hmm.
Is that anything related to the study that was made in Charlottesville? I think it was like 30 births per 1,000, and they have reduced them down to something like 10 to 1,000. Are you familiar with that study? I think it was Charlottesville.
Birth per 1,000. Oh, birth fatality. So
yes.
I'm not familiar with the specifics numbers, but we have looked at premature births and infant mortality and neonatal mortality, and actually that'll be one of the things that you'll be focused on tomorrow is pregnancy outcomes, I believe. I think we just did that at the Charlottesville group last week. And so we'll be reviewing the new updated data for pregnancy outcomes as well. And a lot of work has been done in this area in terms of gaining access and making it easier for women to get to be seen. And I think improvements will be seen. And our intention is not to drop all the activities that have been ongoing in that area, but as part of the evaluation and plan, we'll figure out how we can continue those activities. Because I don't think anyone would say that obesity is solved, for example, but also incorporate any new things that come out of this plan and really try and make them very locally focused at this point.
And I think that last meeting we were, I think I shared with you all that Flu Manor, we had some very positive results in a lot of areas, and we ought to be real proud of what we're doing.
Someone from the group from this planning and community health assessment will come in the fall. It may be someone from the health department, but we're trying to get other members to present as well, to present an overview of the health of Fluvanna. Because I think that will help you understand what your citizens are facing on a day-to-day basis as well. And you know, Ms. Booker has been a really great partner to us in this process, and we have loved having her. And as this moves forward, if any of you are interested in attending any of the meetings, I would invite you to come and participate and be part of this process.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I heard that Mr. O'Brien said that Frisbee golf is good for mental health.
It is, absolutely.
Proven
benefits.
I thought we approved that.
There's some money there for it. We'll just see what happens.
Okay.
Is there anyone else would like to speak? Okay. I would propose that we might switch the agenda around just a second to make sure y'all are okay with that. We have one presentation. Are y'all okay if we go ahead and do the one presentation right
sure.
now?
Sure.
Yeah.
Alrighty. We will move to presentations. Tab G, State Water Resources Plan Briefing. Tammy D. Stevenson, Program Coordinator, Office of Water Supply, Virginia DEQ. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for moving me up. I wasn't expecting that. I was enjoying your meeting. Lots of interesting.
Well, you can stick around out.
The party starts in about an hour.
Well, believe it or not, I had 18 years in local government, and part of that was county administrator, so it was very familiar to me, some of the discussion you had. But anyway, I wanted to talk to you today about the State Water Resources Plan and our development of that. Just to give you a little bit of history, not surprising to anybody, probably, after every drought in the Commonwealth since the 20s, there has been some type of water supply planning, and then we came out of the drought, and it kind of got dropped. Although we had lots of good information. But after the 1998-2002 drought, there was actual regulation that was put into place that required all county, cities, and towns in the Commonwealth to adopt a water supply plan. And that was in cooperation with the states and the state and the regions. So it was a cooperative effort. And there's certain criteria that were required in that legislation, which included all the water sources, all the water uses, projected demands, where you expect to get the demand, the water for that demand, some drought response and contingency plans, and some other criteria. So it's very comprehensive. The state dictated what was in there, but it's your plan. That's what I liked about that. All the plans were due in 2008 and 2011, 2011 being the regional plans, which you submitted a regional plan with then town of Columbia. And our regulation defines a regional plan as two or more localities. So that gave you a little bit of extra time to develop your plan. We took all of those plans and developed the State Water Resources Plan, the first one in the Commonwealth. In that plan, we took all of the information, your information, that was in the water supply plan and some other sources, the water annual water use reporting, which gave us water uses that meet certain thresholds, which I'll explain to you shortly. We put all of that data into a common database. It was about a quarter of a million pieces of data that went into that so that we could look at all of the sources and all of the withdrawals out of those sources and do a cumulative impact analysis, which I'll get into a little more detail shortly. And it was perfect segue in talking about your health plan, that it's not a plan that you developed and put on the shelf. And I had a lot of that concern from localities back in 2006 when we started this process, that we're going through this exercise, put it on a shelf, collect dust like all the other plans. This is a continuous process, and that's why I'm here. Your plans were submitted in 2011. We reviewed them all for consistency with the regulation. All plans in the Commonwealth were found compliant with some conditions, and we're working with the localities and the planning regions right now to meet those conditions, which are due in 2018, which is 5 years from when your plan was found compliant. Then you will resubmit your plan in 2023. That's hard to say. I'm not used to that one. Because your plans were found compliant in 2013. So anyway, it's a continual process, very similar to your comprehensive planning process. You know, public hearing is required, a formal adoption by this board like you did before. So what we found in the State Water Resources Plan, looking at 2010 and to 2040, and 2040 is where we stopped the planning process because that's where all localities and all planning regions went at least that far. And as you can see, the population trend and the water demand are both tracking about the same. Between 2010 and 2040, it's about 32%. We found that we're going to need an additional 450 million gallons a day of water to meet that 2040 demand coming from various sources, but we've split it here between what we're expecting to come from surface water versus groundwater, and I've got the numbers up there for you. Most of the demand is to come from surface water, about 97%. Most of that 97% is going to come from, or expected to come from, 25% of the stream reaches. And a stream reach are sub-watersheds, which I'm going to show you a map of here shortly. And what that tells us is there are certain areas of concern that we need to take a harder look at. And that leads me into the challenges and recommendations that are in the State Water Resources Plan. We had 12 challenges and recommendations in there. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail on a lot of them, but I do want to touch on some of them. The surface water demand I mentioned to you, most of the water in the Commonwealth, 82% of the water, surface water withdrawn, is not permitted. Most of that due to the fact that those withdrawals occurred before our permitting went into place. And unless there's something that triggers a permit, they remain unpermitted. What that means, we do know what those withdrawals are because they still are required to report those withdrawals if they meet the 300,000 gallons a month or 300,000 gallons a month or more withdrawal. But what that does mean is during times of drought, there are no conditions, no restrictions on the withdrawal. And there's not an every 15-year review of that withdrawal and any impacts it may have on downstream users. So what our plan is and what our recommendation was for any of those withdrawals that are not permitted that may have an impact on downstream users, we'll work with the locality, if it's a locality, or work with the locality to get to a self-supplied user or someone else, a company, that may be making that withdrawal to see, one, if they already have conditions in place that we're just not aware of and haven't factored into our modeling, or secondly, if they don't, could we get some conditions in place if we have a drought event? Can we reduce their withdrawal? So we'll be touching on that if we get to that point. Reservoir site development, we know there's some areas that are only going to be able to meet their demand if they have some type of storage, so we'll be working with localities on that. Consumptive use is not a required reporting threshold for us, and it has a great deal of effect on our water balance, so we have recommended that we ask for a change in our regulation to include consumptive use reporting on an annual basis. Threats to water quality, we will continue to do our modeling and add indicators to our modeling, and I will touch on the indicators that we currently use for that. And conflict resolution, we don't want to dictate, we want to facilitate, so we're not proposing that anything else be put into place as far as DEQ trying to resolve conflicts of those resources. Gaps in water withdrawal reporting, I wanted to touch on that because The AWWR is annual water withdrawal reporting that I mentioned to you that everybody, permitted or not, must report to us if they have 10,000 gallons per day or basically averaging 300,000 per month, except for irrigation, which is 1 million per month. And when we looked at the water supply plans, which is what is in red versus what the annual report information that we get, which is in blue, we found that the water supply plans identified some users that we didn't have in our database. And the CWS are community water systems, and you can see there's a big difference there. We think that's probably the smaller private community water systems, some that meet the threshold that we haven't captured, many that don't, but collectively they have a high number. So we want to try to get some of those uses in our system. The large self-supplied users we found were a lot of golf courses that frankly didn't realize they needed to report. We have since contacted all the golf courses and have most of them registered now that do meet the threshold. Agriculture is the last one. You can see we got about twice as much information on those in your water supply plans than we had in our annual withdrawal reporting. And we are currently trying to help you get that information by reaching out to the agriculture community. I myself have visited 4 dairy farms in the last 2 weeks, which is actually very interesting. But they didn't know they had to report. And the reporting requirement has been in place since 1982. It's not a new regulation. But nobody had reached out to them, and they've been very cooperative. I've been very pleased with the results. So hopefully the next time around we'll have a lot more information to factor into our modeling. Some of the other challenges, conservation. Some plans identified some very robust conservation plans that had been in place. Some really hadn't put a lot of thought into it. So we'll just be working with localities to try to get something in place. Infrastructure deficiencies, I'm probably preaching to the choir. There's never enough money to fix those things. We'll be working with the health department, have already started that, to identify particularly the smaller localities. We had some localities that were losing 40% and 50% of their produced water. So, you know, that's too much. But it's when you work on things underground, it's hard to sell because you can't touch it and feel it and see it. So we understand that. So we'll try to identify some money, although there never is enough. Source water protection, there were a lot of plans in place, but not a whole lot of implementation. So we'll be working with the health department and the localities to try to get some of those plans implemented. Climate change issues, we'll try to stay on top of those, factor those into our modeling as we can. Public education and outreach is a key to any type of water conservation and everything that you do. We need to make sure people are aware of our water sources. Current and future risk to groundwater availability, and I know you'll have a lot of groundwater here, groundwater use, and that's an issue because we don't, particularly in the fractured rock system, we don't have a lot of information about the water and the sustainability of it. 23% of the water demand for 2040 is expected to come from groundwater, most of that outside of the groundwater management area. What you see up there, the colors, are those areas that we're not sure that the groundwater recharge will sustain the 2040 demand. The groundwater management area, if you're not familiar with that, is all of the area east of 95. The groundwater withdrawals over 300,000 gallons per month must get a withdrawal permit. West of 95, we don't have that requirement. So,
what does those little colors say?
What does purple mean? Purple's us.
It's there are areas that I can't read from here either.
Between 0.25 and 0.5 million gallons per day per square mile, million gallon yard, MGYs per square mile.
And it's what our modeler came up with with concern that those areas may not have the recharge to sustain the 2040 demands that were listed in the water supply plans.
Meaning groundwater is not a great source for us based on this model.
Okay.
And basically that means we need to do more study before we rely on that at a great level. And I wanted to show you this. This is a map that the lighter gray area over in the right, that is the groundwater management area. And they have aquifer systems that they have a lot of information on. And then there's those of us on the western end of the state. And this map just shows you where those withdrawals are coming from based, you know, the circles, the larger circles are the larger withdrawals, of course. And you don't have a whole lot. You have a few there.
Yeah, two.
Yeah. And this map, again, the groundwater management area, there are 400 monitoring wells, that's USGS and DEQ, that we use. They're not production wells, but they're wells that give us information about the groundwater availability and sustainability. Out of those 400 wells, 360 of them are in the groundwater management area. The other 40, as you can see, are scattered throughout the state, and you don't have any in your county. And a lot of that's because of the groundwater management area, the aquifer system that they have there, and some of the issues they have with not sustaining the demand there. So some of the wells are required as part of the permitting process. But what we want to do is work with localities, particularly those that rely on groundwater and that may not have any groundwater monitoring wells, and see if we can identify some wells maybe that aren't in use that we could use as groundwater monitoring well, or work with them to find the funds to get groundwater monitoring wells in place. So we'll be talking to you about that. And I wanted to talk to you about the cumulative impact analysis that's in the State Water Resources Plan. This map, these little sections here are what I mentioned to you earlier, the stream reaches and their sub-watersheds. And this is the change in demand from 2010 to 2040. The green being greater than 10%, and as you can see, there's a lot of green in there. We do have some who are expecting a decline. When we do the cumulative impact analysis, we are looking at four indicators currently. Changes in August low flow, which is an indicator of your aquatic life. Changes in drought of record is your safe yield. You may have heard of that. That is the most restrictive indicator that we have. Withdrawals as a percentage of September drought warning flows. That's an overall system assessment, and it's an indicator of either during those times you'd have to use less water or be reliant on stored water. Changes in 7Q10 is your waste assimilation. So when we take a look at those indicators and based on the 2040 demand, you can see in the red are those that exceeded all four of those indicators, and the dark orange exceeded three, and the yellow two, and so forth. So you see some areas in the state that we know are likely to have negative impacts on the beneficial uses based on those indicators. And when you put the two maps together, and this the top map is the withdrawals based on the 2040 demands, you see there are areas that are common, the areas that are expected to have high demand, increased demand, and those areas that are expected to exceed those thresholds. So those are the areas we're initially concentrating on working with to make sure that things are in place so they can meet their demand without negative impacts on the beneficial uses.
What are some of the indicators?
I'm sorry?
What are some of the
indicators? The indicators are what these things here that I mentioned to you. And it's all modeling, and I'll tell you I'm not a modeler. But this is how it's been explained to us. And we, as time goes on, we will be adding different indicators here to address other issues that might impact beneficial uses. And this map is just tells you the deficits that were identified in the water supply plans, and again, the same areas that we've circled, you can see that they have high demands. We have prioritized our regions based on those that anticipated a deficit, those that have clustered demands, and those that exceed multiple thresholds, the indicators that I showed you earlier. So where we are now is at the five-year update in 2018, as I mentioned to you. And we are out working with all the planning regions and localities, reminding them all of the compliance items. The letters went out in 2013, personnel changes, et cetera. Want to make sure everybody knows what's expected of them and work with them so we're not up on 2018 trying to meet those deadlines. So, and the other thing is we need to make sure that your information is accurate. You know, some of this information, first iteration of this plan, it's dated. Some people started working on their plans in 2006 and 2007. So what they projected as increased demand then may have changed one way or the other. We want to make sure that we have updated information. And one way we're doing that is through what I told you, we developed a database. And we call this Virginia Hydro, and that's going to be a very interactive system. We're pretty excited about it. Your locality will have access to that system to input your data and keep it updated as often as you think you need it to be. In other words, if you have some big industry coming that you didn't plan on, and you had some housing development, that type of thing. We need to get that information in there so we can factor it into the modeling. So, and one thing that I find exciting for localities as well is it will have the ability to, if you do have an economic development prospect and you want them to locate on a certain piece of land, expecting them to pull water out of a certain source, you'll be able to simulate that to see if it's going to happen without negative impacts. And we'll be working with you on that so that you can say, yes, we can sell this piece of property to this type of industry or that type of thing. So it can be a tool for you to use in your economic development efforts. We'll also be looking at your water demand management, as I mentioned to you, the conservation efforts that you might have in place, your drought response and contingency plan, if you've had to implement that. Did the, you know, a lot of places, a lot of localities didn't have a drought response and contingency plan in place until we went through that drought and this exercise. So they put some triggers in place to go to the different various stages of drought, and they didn't know for sure if they were going to really be realistic or not. So we need to take a look at that and see if anything needs to change. And then some of the alternatives that were stated in your water supply plans to meet your demand, that may have changed. And with that, I'll take any questions that you might have.
When was the last water report we had? Was that that thick book we had?
No, our water resources plan was done in 2010, and then Louise's in 2011, and combined they've been looked at for these new water projects, but we'll have to do the updates coming up. And ours was in concert with Columbia at the time.
Right.
Forthcoming, since Columbia is no longer a town as of July 1st, we'll have to partner with somebody else, but most likely it would be Louise's because of our shared water project. So.
And that's something you won't have to worry about until 2023.
That's right, the 10-year update. Mm-hmm,
for the 10-year update.
Mm-hmm. So the map shows Flavanna as having a projected deficit. Is that something you know about, or either one of you know about?
Yeah, no. We the water pipeline definitely showed that there was a probably, like some localities, for when that was done, probably an overestimate. But as the water projects go in, and as we see a few years of how things go, those numbers will have to be substantially refined. But DEQ also put the same kinds of limits on our James River water withdrawal that says, based on your water supply plans, it would be this tier here, and if you reach this level, then it's this tier, and then you reach this level, it's this tier. But that's based on our projected water supply needs. But at the time that was written, we didn't have the water sources to meet those projected water supply needs. Now,
so it's not inclusive of the James River Water Project?
No. Because the project, while the project was contemplated, then it was not included in there as a source of that. And so I think we've got adequate sources of water. It's not necessarily in the exact right place we'd want it, because it's raw water, and you know, we don't have a plant in the southern part of the county yet. But it is also then combined with the more vexing problem of sewer services to go with the public water system. So,
but that report is not related to the sewer component, is it, in terms of?
Not from my standpoint, just from your standpoint,
yeah.
Right.
Okay, yeah. And then do we have a contingency plan for drought in place or not?
Indeed.
Mm-hmm. Everybody did. If they didn't already have it in place, they did as part of this process.
And we also have the drought conditions and limitations in the James River Water Authority project too for the withdrawals, because there are certain limits on once drought conditions are XYZ, we have to meet certain conditions and reduce usage, reduce withdrawals from the James on that project as well. So, but that's built into almost all the water projects. Some of the private wells. As Tammy mentioned, some of the private wells, well, there's lots of private wells out there that weren't necessarily being reported, and so you don't know who's drawing water from where, the cumulative effect of that. Maybe a bunch of, 5,000 gallons per day, but I think the limit was 10,000 to report, wasn't it?
10,000 a day, yeah. Yes.
So, you get a whole bunch of 5,000 gallon a day permit withdrawals, and you're not reporting that, it pretty soon adds up, so. You saw the monitoring wells in Louisa County. There's one in the Green Springs area, and then one over towards the town of Louisa. And we may need one somewhere along the way, but The only place where we draw significant well water now, other than individual homes and things, is the Fork Union Sanitary District. But we're hoping to bring that fifth, that fourth well on. So.
That was the one thing I noticed when she was putting all those things up, that the only orange spot that we had was around, well, south of the Fork Union District, but around Bremo as well.
Yeah, and I think that was just to, you can correct me, but I think that was just to imply that really the Fork Union District is what mm-hmm. was because that's why we have significant reported water right. withdrawals, and you've got, you know, the military academy and the district itself, but there are many other withdrawals down there that aren't reported because they're below the reporting limits. So the system becomes more mature as it goes on, and as the federal government pushes requirements down to the state and the state pushes it to us, I'm hoping that the most significant natural resource we have, water, is going to get more and more and more scrutiny because it's not an unlimited resource, and right. we're already facing facing particular problems with it.
So we could almost we would not let people dig wells in the future. Could be.
Well, that's a way beyond my knowledge. So
now keep in mind the indicator map that I showed you is surface water. Mm-hmm. Okay. We really don't have enough information to do that ground, type of analysis on the groundwater. Okay. Yes, ma'am.
So I noticed that 82% is what you mentioned as not being
permitted
from mm-hmm. that standpoint. Is that are there efforts, or are the rules more restrictive now, and are there efforts to go retroactively based on a certain amount of draws, or?
Well, when somebody gets a withdrawal permit, I think I'm going to answer your question. If I don't, let me know. But when someone gets a permit, it's for 15 years, and then it's reevaluated. Now we have modeling tools in place that we can look at what impact that withdrawal would have on downstream users. So all of that's factored in. And then we may have conditions on that withdrawal during times of low flow, which are not on unpermitted withdrawals.
But unpermitted withdrawals, when do they come under review? They don't?
They don't, unless something triggers a permit, or unless the governor declares some type of drought.
There's no legislation or plans?
To permit the unpermitted withdrawals would take a statute change, or two statute changes, actually. And we hope not to get to that point. What we hope is that we can just work with people on a voluntary basis to get some conditions in place. And what we found is some actually have them in place. We just weren't aware of them, some of the ones we've already researched. So that's a good thing. And some of the ones we're aware of are in the process of getting a permit for, you know, because they're growing or whatever situation.
And the term subsidence, which I had to look up because I wasn't sure exactly what that was. How big of an issue is that?
On the Eastern Shore and the coastal plain, it's a big issue. And I won't pretend to be an expert on that either. My boss, Scott Cudless, can talk to you all day about that and very well explain it if you want to know more information about that. And the Hampton Roads Planning District Commission has a lot of good information on their website about that as well. But it is a real issue.
When you look it up, what does it mean?
It's basically where the land sinks in part because of
like when you suck in the water out of the well, and it's
sometimes the water's not put back in, it changes the consistency of the soil, changes more to peat, and so that it can sink as well too. So.
I'm a mountain girl, so you know that was all new information to me when I came to DEQ. So, but if you want more information on it, I can certainly point you in the right direction there.
So we add something else to this list to monitor what she's talking about?
Oh, the water supply plans are on there.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
Thank you so very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I hope
we appreciate you coming in and getting us up here.
Thank you for inviting me. Appreciate it. Thanks, Steve.
Yes, ma'am. All righty, folks. We'll now move to action matters. First tab is going to be tab B, agreement for the water hazard mitigation grant. Had water on my brain. Their hazard mitigation grant program for the acquisition of four properties. Columbia. Jason Stewart, Planning and Zoning Administrator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. This is simply a long-awaited agreement between Thomas Jefferson Planning District Commission and Louisiana County in regards to managing a FEMA grant originally applied for by the town of Columbia some time back. And the terms of the grant agreement require a 5% matching that was originally agreed to by the town of Columbia, which is a total of $9,975. And this is used for the greater purpose of removing four extremely dilapidated structures in the floodplain within the limits of the soon-to-be-former town of Columbia.
And those funds, too, were already transferred when we did the transfer of funds from Columbia. The funds are in the county's coffers. And so you had pre-agreed when you signed the agreement with Columbia last spring or summer to uphold that obligation to pay the 5% portion of that grant application.
Looks like the fire department could volunteer over there on some of those houses.
You know, we actually asked about that a couple of times. There are unfortunately a lot of state rules that preclude you from just doing burn buildings like you used to, asbestos and other things that are in the facilities. But as I've said multiple times before, if this doesn't go through, I'm going to find any way I can to get a community effort to go in and, if a landowner will agree to take their facility down for them, just to, I don't care who owns
carbon
the land.
Glass.
I want it to make it more safe and to look better. But we'll work with these landowners. But it's all part of one family or extended family, and those are the four structures that are included in there. So between now and next September, we have to try to get to an agreement and get to a sales price, and then get the mitigation done.
It's a shame to have spent almost $200,000 on a project like this with federal, state, and local funds to do something that you could do with a match almost, or at least some of it anyway.
Mr. Weaver, I completely agree. This, the one, the building in the bottom left, someone tried to start doing some renovations on that stuff, and even the person that was doing that found out that it's just not salvageable at all. Now, we'll still want to get in these facilities and have the Historical Society go in and Preservation Virginia go in and maybe salvage a fireplace, framework or something. Now, I doubt that anything much like that that would be salvageable or worth any money is left, but we'll certainly take a look at all those areas. And some of the town residents certainly have some ideas about what would be useful on those plots, but they would be owned by the county once they are sold and raised. We would own those plots of land that would just remain green space.
Is it true that people have been living in these homes?
Squatters? No. The one on the top left, the one on the top right, the one on the bottom left, no, absolutely not. Not for several years. The one on the bottom right, it seems to me about three and a half or four years ago, there were still some people in there. There aren't now, to my knowledge. But there are other homes along, if you look like right here on the map, that's the big green structure. There are people in there, and there's substantive problems there. These two units, the White House and the Yellow House, have substantive issues we know of for sure, and there are people living in there. There are people living in here.
Post office.
I think that's the old post office, right? And then some of these other ones do, too. This one's still empty. That's the convenience center.
I think at one point in time somebody was trying to rent portions of those, but
they were, and even the existing ones that are being rented here, there's, you wouldn't want to live there, and that's saying it really nicely. So it's
what about the building across from the building down at the left with the orange doors?
This orange door one is right down here,
right,
just really as you're coming across the town. This one is not on the list.
Yeah.
I don't think that falls in the floodplain. I think the floodplain comes right along here. It's not, I don't know if it's habitable at all, but it's completely empty.
No, it's not.
No, there's definitely
not
in
the corner of the street.
But I think I didn't bring the floodplain maps with me, but I could pull up electronically. But the floodplain is a little bit of an odd.
It goes up and it goes down and then back up again.
Yeah, and then it goes up through a valley here. And
That's a low area, creek bottom. So it goes back up that creek bottom.
So anyway, that's the picture of the facility.
And then, So then after this is done, the other places down there, we have to negotiate to see, what do we do?
We have to negotiate the purchase of these properties.
Purchase of them, okay.
And that, now, two things. A, That will be an ongoing project between county staff and Thomas Jefferson Planning District Commission and our county attorney. But also, in the coming very short months, we'll start ramping back up again on the Town of Columbia Task Force to keep people briefed up on what's going on and to look at some downstream impacts and effects of this. I briefed a big group of town citizens. It's been 2.5 or 3 months ago now, and we had just gotten the updated maps with the, showing the drawings. So that map you just saw, they've seen that. So the word has gotten kind of around in Columbia what's going on, but the grant had been approved at that time. It hadn't been released. Now it's ready to go, and we're ready to sign the agreement. So, and it goes from February, when it came out, through September 17th, I think, next year. So, and I did modify the motion just slightly to make it a little more clear. And so when you get ready to do a motion, just please read the one off the screen.
So you're saying we have to negotiate to buy those seven properties?
Yes, sir.
What's that exactly mean? I mean,
it means that if that property is valued at $5,000, and I can show you the exact valuations of it, but if the property is valued at $5,000, it's a little difficult under this grant application to pay much more than what it's assessed at. Now, the seller can request a formal assessor to come in and look at it. But let's say it comes in at $5,100. Well, then $5,100 is probably going to be the offer, unless the locality puts some additional funds in. And there's not a lot of ability under the grant terms to pay more than what the value would be.
So the grant is hopefully will cover that cost.
Well, absolutely. If, for instance, let's say we go negotiate with those landowners and they don't want to sell any of them, well, then the grant's done, we walk away, we're over. Because there's only certain ways you can use this grant funds, and that would be to purchase the property, to tear the structures down, remove the debris, et cetera, but you can only pay a certain amount. And so this could easily be, within the next 6 months, over and starting from square one again. Or it could be that there'll be offers and counteroffers, but it's not going to be too much offer and counteroffer because it's either going to be this amount or not. And so we're at a pretty critical juncture here. And I was waiting for the formal approvals before we start meeting. So now Thomas Jefferson Planning District Commission, our attorney and myself will start meeting to talk about how to do the approach here and get the paperwork ready. But there are very specific rules you have to follow because of this federal grant.
And can the properties be condemned?
Yes, that's a little different story. And I would gladly condemn those and others down there just to get them torn down. But if you condemn them, I'm not sure what the rules are for who pays for the teardown and when and the time frame and
the owner
and finding a home for the people.
The owner does.
Well, these don't have any people in them, so you don't have to find a home.
Okay. Sure, but yeah, I know these don't. So that,
the threat of condemning it would be enough to leverage it.
Remember, there's two meanings to the word condemn. One is where the county acquires it, acquires property for county purposes. The other one is to order the property removed
because
or secured or whatever it might be.
Safety hazard.
There's a statute on that, and we have. I guess the county didn't do it, but the town of Columbia did, and I represented the town of Columbia when it did it, and it was some of these same owners. And what you do is you order the building secured or removed or whatever it needs to make it safe, and if it isn't done, then the locality can do whatever's necessary to remove it. And it looked to me like several of those buildings, the only thing you could do would be to take them down. And if that happens, then the locality pays for it, but assesses the owner for the cost, and it becomes a lien on the property in the nature of a tax lien. So it's a pretty efficient process.
What happens if the lien on the property is greater than the value of the property? Does the person just abandon the property?
You sue the owner.
You still sue the owner for the costs at that point.
Yeah.
So they would have a strong incentive to negotiate that.
I was just looking at the names up there. Those owners are familiar with this process.
Very familiar. And one of them is an attorney. Anyway, it's at least we've, this is a significant step over the last 3 years. The grant finally got approved. The Department of, or the DHCD grant did not come through, and I don't expect we can meet the requirements of that in Columbia anywhere for housing structures to build new housing just because of the population. But I want to see any movement on a change in look on Route 6.
Right.
I want to, I'm going to, if it hasn't done already, I'm going to, we'll take a chainsaw down, we'll cut that silly green sign down that's been up there for 4 or 5 years that's a, you know, federal grant, whatever, that's been shot up 50 times. Cut it down. I'm gonna work with the people that have that that old SUV that's got flat tires and sitting, not SUV, RV. You know, it's just, it just is a eyesore safety hazard. And if I were a kid still living down there, I'd be in every one of those houses all the time. Because I did it all the time as a kid, but I'm lucky that I didn't get lockjaw from step on a nail or fall through the floor and break my face or something. But
got whipped more than once down there.
Yeah, it's fun and cool, except that there's rats and mice and raccoons. And
people who have to come into the county that way, that really, they're for
the folks who live there shouldn't have to look at it every day.
What is that place down there? What place? Yeah, it's...
So anyway, the new motion is on the screen. Yes, ma'am.
I'll make the motion.
Okay. You need to move?
I'll make the motion.
Okay. You got it, Ms. Seeger?
Yes, I move to approve the agreement entitled Agreement for the Hazard Mitigation Grant Program between the Thomas Jefferson Planning District Council and Savannah County for the specified term of February 29, 2016 to September 15, 2017, and with a $9,975 payment as a required 5% match to the Thomas Jefferson Planning District Commission, and authorize the county administrator to execute the agreement subject to the county attorney approval as required.
Second. The motion has been made by Ms. Seeger and seconded by Mr. O'Brien. All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? Chair votes aye. Motion passes 5-0. Thank you very much. We'll move on to action matter C. Establishment of the Economic Development and Tourism Advisory Council. Jason Smith, Director of Economic Community and Economic Development, and Aaron Spitzer, Interim Director of Parks and Recreation.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. I'm here to talk to you about the proposed establishment of EDTAC. EDTAC stands for Economic Development and Tourism Advisory Council. And what we're trying to do is to plan to promote Savannah County as both the ideal business location as well as an affordable tourist attraction. Through this, we're looking for individuals that want to be on a working committee. We want to try to do video promotions, brochures, and update the website to try to get people from outside the county to come to Flavanna County. Do you have any questions? I think you have this in front of you, correct?
Yeah, they do. One note, it struck me the other day, and I don't know why I didn't think about this before, but I didn't really understand the structure when I first got here with the Economic Development Authority and the Economic Development Commission. But the board dissolved the Economic Development Commission and rolled those kinds of functions into kind of a subcommittee of the EDA in the fall of 2012, I believe. Well, this almost sounds the flavor a bit more like the Economic Development Commission coming back, but because the potential for development is happening, we really need a marketing arm, a tourism arm, and some advice and guidance support on economic development things. But to do that, I want to harness a lot of the talents from citizens in our community. And a lot of them have great ideas and can do things. So that...
what do you have? Just, what is it? Just the car? Oh, I packed up the car.
What?
No. Oh, you packed up the car.
This is a new council.
Yeah. So, but I mean, but even a marketing campaign for the Flavanna Community Business Forum. You know, there's a lot of smart people and talented people that could work on that or have suggestions or ideas. So it's not a cost program. It's really to advise and assist and support staff and bring ideas to the board. But it gets some from each district, some business people involved, and others from key organizations as kind of a support mechanism. So that's why it's proposed, and it was part of your 2016-17 strategic planning initiatives.
Right. Yeah, we have it.
Okay.
There's some advantages to focusing on the tourism aspect as well, too.
I think so. And that's I modeled this after I searched dozens and dozens of counties around the Commonwealth. I'm sorry, around the country, and looked at, some of them have the similar name, I like acronyms, and EdTac was easy to say, but some were focused more on economic development, some on tourism, some on marketing, but the flavor and blend of all of them, when we pull it together, end up being something like this, and this seemed to be doable in our community, and with the breadth of talent we have around, I think we can tap some good people to do some good work with, without having to pay a lot extra to get those ideas.
So when do we come with our person from our district?
Well, we'll put off the call for nominations for the volunteers for the five districts for those seats, and we'll ask the business community to put volunteers together. The chamber, the historic society will come from theirs. But there's no reason why you can't advocate for an individual person to put their name in, because then the applications will come in just like any other appointment, and you'll consider those. Okay. And I actually have some recommendations from various citizens that have kind of been involved a little bit already, and I will encourage them to put their names in from various districts too. We're looking really for skill sets. For instance, I know one citizen that is very good at videography things and marketing, and I know another one that's good at this type of thing. So if you go down to this paragraph 4 on the bottom of page 2, these skills, ability to make proactive and positive contributions to enhance business and tourism, that's just a rah-rah statement. But we're also looking for to conceptualize, develop, and prioritize economic development and tourism projects, principles of marketing and advertising, skills in creation and development of marketing materials, knowledge of the use of analytics and tracking to perform website search and website optimization, those types of things. So we're looking for skill sets like that. So this is really meant to be a fairly active doing board. People that come up with ideas, put stuff, put their knowledge in, put this and those. If we need approvals, we bring it to the board. If we don't, the staff just carries it on. But this is a working committee. So
and we
model the meetings on the second Monday of the month to follow right after the Economic Development Authority meetings, because there's a tie in there too.
And they would work for how long?
Well, the committee appointments are based on the charter here are based on 3-year appointments with the ability to reappoint.
Oh, okay.
This is a regular board commission committee. Right.
Okay.
It says reduce barriers to business development. What are we thinking about in those terms?
So I can tell you that one of the things, if you look at some of the feedback from the community business survey, one of the big things talked about was sign ordinance and the various barriers that it creates for businesses on from sign ordinance. Also about how can we get help with marketing. So one of the things I've got on this group's list is, can we create a community business events calendar? So, for instance, when there's going to be a small business Saturday where they shop at a certain place, or they've got a speaker coming into town that does small business e-commerce, or does website marketing, or does social media marketing for small businesses. We'd like to be able to get that kind of information out to small businesses. And there are 1,000,000,000 hurdles for a small business in today's world. They don't necessarily have enough resources to have their own of this, but they could share resources with another business potentially. So what barriers are there? Lots, if you ask a business. But what barriers would you attack? I don't know. That's the purpose of the committee, is to see if there are barriers, and if they are, address it. It doesn't mean, to reassure you, it doesn't mean that the county is going to hand them, $40,000 to support their business. I'm talking about things we can do legally and from a business support point of view, not a business funding point of view.
Yeah, I guess I'm wondering why we hadn't done this before then, for the last 4 years or something like this.
Well, because if we thought of all the good ideas that people come up with in the world and add them on your plate today, there's no way we could do all of them. So why didn't the manned flight come up before the Wright brothers? I don't know. Because you can't think of every good idea every day. But the Economic Development Commission did do a lot of this kind of work.
You knew we needed 4 years ago. Why didn't you come up with
In business, you judge results. In business, you judge results. Think about that. That's all I have to say.
I don't have it.
So does that mean we don't? I mean, there's nothing that says you have to do this. It was part of your strategic initiatives. I put a charter together. We vetted it with various organizations. It is a way for us to tap skills in the community and also support our staff without increasing staff as the workload increases. It's an idea. Mm-hmm. Why wasn't it a good idea 4 years ago? Well, it was, except that when I first started, this board directed me to go find all the boards, commissions, and committees that right. we didn't need. Mm-hmm. I put the big list together, and one of them that got chopped was Economic Development Commission.
And because their stuff was rolled in the EDA. It's just the right time when ideas pop up because we are concentrating more on economic development. This is the time. Before, you know, we were just starting. We were just building the foundation, finding out about things. That idea would have never, and I think I'm a very creative person, would have never come up at that time.
I'm not sure why we didn't have fan mail in 2010, but
yeah,
ideas pop up.
Yeah, they do.
Are you ready for a motion?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, I move that the Board of Supervisors approve the proposed charter and structure for the Economic Development and Tourism Advisory Council to be effective immediately.
Second. Motion's been made by Ms. Seeger, seconded by Mr. O'Brien. All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? Right. Chair votes aye. Passes 5-0. Thank you very much.
You did a nice job with your first time standing before these monsters. Not me.
Thank you.
Speaks the truth.
We'll move on to tab D. Appointment to TJPDC, Rural Transportation Advisory Council. Mr. Nichols.
Sure. This is just appointing Jason Stewart from Planning and Zoning Department, our administrator, to replace Mr. Popowitz on the TJPDC, Rural Transportation Advisory Council. And so we just need your codification of that because we send the appointment letter to TJPDC.
We have a motion.
Yes.
I move to appoint Jason Stewart, Planning and Zoning Administrator, replacing Bobby Popowitz to the TJPDC Rural Transportation Advisory Council effective immediately.
Second.
Motion been made by Mr. O'Brien, seconded by Ms. Booker. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Chair votes aye. Passes 5-0. Move on to tab E. E911 radio project, utilizing project contingency funds. Ms. Ellie.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Okay. What I have before you is to talk about specifically about the renovations for the dispatch center, but in order to talk about that, and the furniture, we need to talk a little bit about the overall what we're seeing at this point for the overall need for contingency dollars for the project. So the first thing that I wanted to show you is a quick update on the project timeline. And with the decision to not do all the co-leasing on the commercial towers and to build additional towers, that will extend the timeline for the project a little bit. At this point, we don't know quite how long, and that's what we're working on. But it is possible to get those towers built and the equipment on the towers and to be able to use the system within the contracted schedule, which it would be by the end of this year. It'll mean that the coverage testing wouldn't be able to be done until spring because that has to be done with full leaves on the trees. So there's that. We're still within being able to get the project done within the time frame that was scheduled. There's a number of other unknowns that will affect the schedule itself. The frequency acquisitions, we need to have the sites absolutely nailed down before we can go to the FCC to get the frequencies. The co-location leases for the two companies that own the towers that we're going to be co-leasing on, we're in negotiations with them, but sometimes that can take a little bit of time. The site development processes, the acquisition of the land at the lake is in process. But then making sure that it's normal soils, you know, so just things that can present some speed bumps. The site equipment installation should go fairly easily, but it depends on all these other things. and then of the fall foliage that I had mentioned. The funding, funding overview of what the project had, you will recall that the project funds, there was $7.5 million initially appropriated for this project. There was some money used for JABA, the narrowbanding part of the requirements, and then the bottom underneath the green section, these are things directly related to the RFP, and then also the contract itself. These radios here for the courthouse, we discovered that the radios that the sheriff's office was using here in the court system actually didn't work in this building. So we upgraded those radios. I thought it was a really good idea if they could actually get out. So we updated those radios, and those radios are not, like, they won't be thrown away or anything when they're done. They're actually going to be the ones that Public Works will be using. And then the sheriff's deputies will be upgrade. It's actually an upgrade with the radio that's coming into the system. So that's not a, it's not wasted dollars at all. We would have had to do that anyways. So this leaves, for the contingency that we went into the project, to start the project, $286,000. From what I understand, when you're dealing with projects of this size, you often want to look at a 10% contingency fund for as things go forward, and we have much, much less than that.
And if you recall the history, there was money pulled out of it multiple times, and so we would have had $400,000 to $600,000 in contingency, but that got drawn down before the project even got started.
So what I'm going to show you this evening is the 911 center renovation and what everything that's going to be that needs to be put into that to get that center up to up to standard. And we're asking for not to exceed $98,000, and I'll show you some more detail on that. To show you what else we have coming up is with the new tower construction, you put a wedge in with an additional $750,000. You will see we have a huge presentation for you next, a plan for your next board meeting on the change order that would be coming forward for the sites. But right now what we're looking at is that the sites themselves are right around that $750,000. There are some adjustments that will need to be made due to the site moves. For example, the Carter's Mountain site where we were did not have a building, because we were going to reuse and repurpose an existing building that was on the mountain. But with moving that to a location here at the lake site, there is no building. So there's that additional cost. And then there's a line that, and I'll describe this obviously more in detail next week, for the additional site construction management and project management for the project. So that would leave a deficit of about $70,000 in the kitty. Now that would be okay if that's all that we were aware of coming up. There's a number of known unknowns, so to speak, and I've listed a number of things here. And at this point, I really can't give you estimates on what that's going to be. I know there are some additional antennas and equipment. For example, a new antenna for the school system will go onto the sheriff's tower so that we can connect dispatch to the school system. That particular antenna is not in the equipment list at this point. R56 is a environmental standard for Motorola equipment. It's based on some of the national electrical standards, but it's a little higher standard than what might be. It's more exceptional rather than passing if you're looking at a schedule. And they did for us a pre-audit of the sheriff's office equipment room and of the sheriff's office per se. After everything is installed, they will again come back and look at it. And it's essentially an audit of the environment that the Motorola equipment would be in. If we would choose not to fix things that come up as failed in that audit, then it doesn't invalidate the warranty of the Motorola equipment. But if something happens because of our inaction, the warranty won't cover it. For example, with the pre-audit that we had them do, we failed 70% of the items. Most of the things have to do with grounding or proper grounding. And like the floor system, the raised floor system, for example, is not properly grounded in the way that they would expect. So there's things that like that that we can weigh of, is that, would that cause an equipment failure? Probably not. But other things that the HALO, and I know this is getting technical, but in the equipment room, there is a HALO around the inside of the room that if lightning would strike, it'll connect with that HALO and send it around so that it doesn't destroy anything. There are 90-degree bends in that HALO, which means electricity goes like water, so it will go right through it. You want round areas, not bends. That's something that we would need to correct, because that could cause an equipment failure.
Why was it put in that way to begin with?
I don't know, sir. I mean, I don't know. I mean, there's a number of things just with grounding. The little tower that's attached to the sheriff's tower, one leg of it is grounded with a rod into the ground, but not all three. So that's not really, it's maybe passable. That one I would even doubt whether it's passable. But there's just things that maybe over the years haven't, or maybe they weren't done correctly in the beginning. Maybe the standards have changed. So what we need to do is on the audit, there's a very few things that will be corrected when the new equipment comes in. For example, if something is not properly sealed where the cabling comes into the room, that when new cabling comes in, they will properly seal that. There are a few things like that. Then we will have to look at the rest of it with the final audit, what things could cause equipment failure and which things would not. And then we will likely have to come back and say, what else do we need, what else with an estimate of being able to fix that.
I have a question.
Yes.
The cost of the landfills and lake sites.
Yes.
At that price, what are you purchasing? Is it just the 100x100 foot pad?
Oh no! It's the tower itself and the lighting equipment, for example. And I'll show you that in those pricing in detail of what it is. I mean, but that's the tower.
300-foot tower, a 250-foot tower, the pad, the structure, the lighting. I mean, it's to build a functional tower to build with the antennas on.
Right.
And hopefully, because of the height they will be, and because of the height we will be at, that there'll be some commercial applications for lower on those sites that will help us defray cost over time. Because they're in pretty good locations for where commercial carriers might like a lower cost alternative, especially the one at the landfill.
And the other thing that we did look at, you said look at, the possibilities of a 350-foot tower. When we went back and looked at what the path studies were for how high we would need the equipment, our equipment doesn't need to be at 350 feet. So we also looked at, commercial carriers, the sweet spot for cell carriers is between 150 and 250 feet. So if our equipment doesn't, if we don't need 100 feet between 250 and 350, the tower doesn't need to be 350. And so then you save money overall. And the landfill, for example, we only need it to be 250. So we would have plenty of space in there for carriers. The one at the lake will need to be 300 feet in order to make the connection with Kent Store. So we have a little bit more there. But rather than building a 350-foot tower, when if we don't need all that space for the county, carriers are not likely to go on there either, because they don't amplify their signal. And once you get above 250 feet, there's a lot of degradation in the signal coming back down. So they're just not going to use it.
And when we say at the lake, we don't mean at the lake.
Right,
we mean
right.
In the vicinity of Lake Monticello. And again, you've seen some of the lines below. I'll show you some later on tonight, too, on what sites and properties we're looking at. But it's in the vicinity of Lake Monticello.
Right.
You know, when you're talking about this, I think it would have been wise maybe if this ties in. You gave us documentation on the towers in the past, dated February 17th, has a lot of those cost projections and how much revenue that we're going to have.
We can do that for next time, yeah. with the additional costs and what, you know, what
it'll,
will be
it'll
there.
It'll be one option. It'll sure. be the final option, which is to build the towers and then those heights. So yes, sir.
So this is just to show you what we've used the contingency dollars so far and what we're anticipating in this. I actually don't foresee anything being major in here at this point. But I, again, major meaning over $100,000. But at this point, I really don't know what all this is going to be.
So we might be over budget then for that.
We're $70,000 over.
There's not much of a chance that it, with $286,000 as a contingency pot on a $7 million project that we weren't going to be. But we've been kind of saying that all along. And part of it now, if you took the two towers out and the additional site prep and the buildings, you could still be under budget, but then you've got much higher long-term costs on the cost of using those towers. So while this might be a little more expensive in the front end, it's a lot cheaper for us long-term to maintain. So, but we just didn't have enough contingency built in this project either, like the present
10% didn't cover.
We didn't have 10%.
You didn't have 10%.
No, we had about 300,000. Out of $7 million project, if we did $600,000 or $650,000,
yes,
we wouldn't be talking to you now.
Okay,
right. So, I mean, other than building the towers, because that was a new ad,
yeah.
But all the things associated with it would have been within contingency.
And one of the things that we're doing too that I think will save us some additional money and downstream also is with the frequency acquisition. There is a we've talked before about doing some things collaboratively with the radio system with Louisa County, and their studies and needs assessments and the consultant working with them has recommended that they join our system.
I think that's a good
which we've
idea.
Talked about. So when I talk about the frequency acquisition and licensing, what we're looking at is when we're doing the exploration of what frequencies will work in our system, we're also talking with Louisa about those same frequencies, because their pot of frequencies and our pot of frequencies, we want to make sure they mesh and work up front. We would only license ours and they would license theirs, but if they work for both counties, then when we get to that point, we're all better off and we don't have to go back to scratch to try to look for frequencies again. So we're trying to do that as we go through the project. All right, so to the dispatch center renovations. The big portion of this is the dispatch furniture, and you do have the contract in front of you for this furniture here. But as we were looking at putting the new equipment that's coming in that is part of the contract, I mean, the consoles themselves for the positions for dispatch are about $50,000 a piece. That's already in the
15.
$50,000 for each position, for the dispatch position, for the CAD, for the soft or the equipment that's coming in. That's a part of the contract that Motorola has already provided. Right, part of the radio project. So the if you've been in the dispatch center at all, you've noticed that the furniture itself is literally falling apart. And so this proposal is to look at getting the new furniture, and then in order to do that, we're going to need to move the dispatch center temporarily from the center where it is into the EOC training room for the time period to be able to replace the worn floor tiles, lighting, painting. There is some electrical rework of circuits, both for the temporary space. I'm trying to get away from doing that and to be able to utilize what they have, but we know that there is a power shortage in the dispatch center itself that we want to make sure we get that right, because if you don't have redundancy in there, if one power surge could take out, you know, the whole whole section of the dispatch center, and that's not acceptable. So there is some in vendor cost with relocating getting the vendors to come in and put everything into the temporary space, have Public Works come in and do the work, and then to move to have the new furniture and equipment come in, get that installed. The installation of the new equipment obviously is included in the contract itself, in the radio project, so that's not included. That you don't have those funds there. We're still working on the dispatch chairs, and because I understand because that is less, that's just a purchase that won't come to you, but we've marked here about $5,000. I'm not sure if that's going to be enough. Those chairs are anywhere from $1,000 to about $1,800 a piece.
How many chairs?
I need five. This is what the furniture is going to look like. To give you an idea of, this is what it kind of the structure of it and the color. This is the layout. This is the door. The door comes over here to come into the dispatch center. And they're right now they have it set out like this, with the desks facing out. And so they've done it in a plus design, but just be three dispatchers units here, and then the supervisor will be in this area with the supervisor dispatch console set up here, and then more of a workstation on this side. And these units are about $14,000-$15,000 a piece for this section like this. Which is that's par for the course. Renovation schedule. What we're looking at is it'll take 8 to 12 weeks to order the furniture. So if you approve moving forward with this budget and approve the contract for the furniture, then we can order that. And depending on the ETA of the furniture, then we can schedule the rest of the move to be able to get everything installed. The radio equipment is already here. It's been here in storage since February. So, and we had asked for that to be available at the beginning of the project because we know that they're currently operating with end of life and end of service equipment in the dispatch center. So it's no doesn't make sense not to have the new equipment available for them as soon as we can. So we're looking at a July-August installation time.
And where do we move the EOC during this time in case we need to stand up the EOC?
Well,
okay, so
we'll have to figure that one out.
Because we're going to need to have a temporary EOC plan thought out, because if we have a catastrophic event when the old place is closed,
hurricane comes through.
Yeah,
like
probably
tornadoes. I mean, you know, whatever. We need to be able to.
Yeah, we would have to still have the conference room at the sheriff's office.
The little one.
That would be all you have. At the sheriff's office, but
okay,
we'll talk about it.
Connectivity is possible and stuff.
Yeah.
Everywhere.
And that's another reason why we want it to be as little time as possible out of that, and to be able to get the work done and the move in. So then these would be the two motions that I would be asking for you, from you. Any questions? Additional questions? Sorry to be the bearer of bad news.
Well, it's not necessarily so bad, because the dispatch center rework has been talked about for the last a little over a year in concert with the CAD software, the computer-aided mm-hmm. dispatch software that was part of the CIP. Replacing the structure, the units in there has been talked about, and the sheriff's mentioned before too. But it's from here forward, every time there's another little change, it's going to bite into that. Now, again, the downstream side looks better, because the mm-hmm. revenue stream may be better on having those towers in place based on the projections, and that's better than trying to pay an escalating cost for renting space on towers that we don't have any control over. And
yeah,
so it's good long term, but it doesn't mean doesn't take a bite now.
If we had the cash, I would actually recommend that we build all of the towers. Just because of the uncertainty, and it's a 3% increase usually on a yearly basis for those fees. So even though we negotiated good prices now, and it goes up 15% in 5 years. So
do we do both of those, remove them, I mean, we make the motions individually?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. You all ready for, the first one?
Ms. Anker, y'all ready?
Yes.
I move the Board of Supervisors approve the renovation budget on the E911 Dispatch Center not to exceed $98,000 with funds from the E911 project contingency.
Do we have a second?
Second.
Motion been made by Ms. Booker and seconded by Mr. Weaver. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Chair votes aye. It's 5-0. Second motion.
I move to issue a purchase order to Unicon in the amount of $64,059.20 for the purchase of dispatch furniture for the E911 Center with funds from the E911 project contingency, and further authorize the county administrator to execute the purchase order.
Second.
Second.
Motion been made by Ms. Booker and seconded by Mr. O'Brien. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Chair votes aye. Motion passes 5-0. Thank you very much. Now we'll move to the consent agenda. Does anyone have any questions about the consent agenda? Mr. Weaver?
No, I don't.
One note that I want to add, if you'll bear with me here for a second. If you go to tab K, I'm going to pull up on the screen here for you. Tab K, we modified the language in there to add the list of the types of permits, fees, and building inspection fees and ENS fees we're talking about. Ms. Elliott identified some additional ones for those tower build. So what she did is just rework the document and just list, sketch plans, major plans, ENS plan review, ENS permit, what the various costs were. And the new motion just states that I move to waive all county assessed building, ENS, and planning and zoning fees associated with the construction of 3 public safety towers, site and antenna modifications, etc. So that we don't have to come back each time there's one. This is the 3 tower projects, so we can waive the fees. That way they've got it downstairs, because our ordinances currently don't allow us to, I mean, there's no automatic waiver in there. We'll come back with that in a new ordinance. Sure. So there's just a new motion there, and it's built into your consent agenda, so I wanted to show you that.
So we need to make a separate motion on that?
I don't think so. It's on the record now and acknowledged, okay. And it'll be part of the action report.
Once we approve the consent agenda, everything's
right. Yes, sir.
Okay, is anyone?
I move to approve the consent agenda, which is minutes of April the 13th, minutes of April the 20th, ratification of purchase action. It's a furniture purchase of $300, E911 tower planning, and the year 16 Department of Social Services insurance claim.
Second. Motion has been made by Mr. Weaver, seconded by Mr. O'Brien. All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? Chair votes aye. 5-0. And we have no unfinished business. Now, under new business, we do have young man making Eagle Scout this Saturday, Mr. Tyler Gavrilovic.
And Mr. Gavrilovic is his Eagle Scout is currently coming up this weekend. So because we got that package late, we didn't want to not have a resolution for him. So it's the same resolution as normal there. And Mr. Sheridan's got the hard copy over there to sign. And then the motion would be the same as always. Normally be on your consent agenda, but we need somebody to just read this one since we added it on separate.
I move that the Susquehanna County Board of Supervisors adopt the resolution entitled Recognizing Tyler Andrew Gavrilovic.
Exactly. Mr. G.
Yeah. For award of Eagle Scout status.
Second.
So a motion has been made by Ms. Seeger, seconded by Mr. Weaver. All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
All opposed? Chair votes aye. Motion passes 5-0. I will ask this month. It is 4 o'clock.
Oh, yeah, I can make 4 o'clock.
You can make 4 o'clock?
Yeah.
Okay. Because I've agreed to be on a tractor for Miss McGee at Old Farm Day.
I get to do the pie eating judging.
I want to eat the pie. Sheriff has to be the champ on that one.
Where's the ceremony?
It's at Lake Christian.
Oh, Oh, okay.
It's at Lake Christian. Yes, ma'am. Oh, good. I was going to ask if anyone else could make it, because we possibly may have a baseball game Saturday.
Right.
The rain is not cooperating with our baseball schedule right now. We're spending a lot of quality time in the gym.
So that's Saturday at what time?
It is Saturday at 4 o'clock at Lake Christian Church. But
Ms. Booker, want to go?
He's a fine young man. I had the pleasure.
I'll see if I
can. I
have a graduation in Richmond, then I'll come back to Old Farms Day, but I have something at 2. But I could go over, but if you want to do it.
Okay, I can do that.
Okay. You want to let me know?
Yeah.
Okay, wonderful.
Thank you.
It's a nice ceremony. I love to see the young man.
Sorry about that. Son's going to a band concert. My wife's going, I need somebody to tie. I can tie it, but he's got to lay down.
That's what clip-ons are. That's what clip-ons are.
I had to get a funeral home joke in.
You need to tie it and just never untie it.
Yeah,
she's doing deadpan humor, though.
Oh, I don't even crack a smile on it anymore. You know. So, all right. Do we have anything else?
I have something to bring up under new business.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Yes, ma'am.
Just recently, I found out that people are having trouble getting mortgages on larger parcels. If you buy, I don't know, 5 acres, the bank will only do 2 acres. So I think we need to ask the Planning Commission to do some research to see whether our ordinances can accommodate that in some way.
Okay.
My suggestion would be that you actually task somebody, maybe the planning department, to investigate the nature of the problem.
Right.
Because that may be a more isolated problem than you think it is. It may be a general problem. I don't know. But I think we ought to know that before we task the planning commission with amending the ordinances.
I've sold some land recently, and both people could not get mortgages.
That's probably dependent on the proposition that the lender characterizes a house site at a certain size.
It's 2 acres.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, but it may be one lender or a limited number of lenders, mm-hmm, or whatever it might be.
Okay, can we task the planning department to look into that? Okay, thank you.
Strange.
No, it has to do with saleability.
Oh, it does. Oh.
Yeah, the idea is that banks want to be sure, right, that when they have security in a property, mm-hmm, if they need to foreclose it, that it can easily be sold. Right. The problem is, if you have a house and building site, which 5 acres essentially is, it's going to cost more than a house building site that's 1 acre, 2 acres, or whatever it might, mm-hmm, be, and that limits the market for a foreclosure sale. So I suspect that's what the problem is.
Okay, so are we good now?
We're good.
We're good? Okay, anyone else? Do you have any business? Okay, I will now open the floor for the second round of public comment. Anyone wishing to speak, come to the microphone. Please state your name and address. Keep your comments to 5 minutes and keep them addressed to the board. Anyone wishing to speak? We'll now close second round of public comment. Closed meeting. We do not have one tonight, correct?
We have four items, and we'll go ahead and.
Four. Sorry. Go ahead, sir.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I move the Louisiana County Board of Supervisors enter into a closed meeting pursuant to the provisions of Section 2.2-3711A.1, Section 2.2-3711A.3, Section 2.2-3711A.6, Section 2.2-3711A.7 of the Code of Virginia, 1950, as amended for the purpose of discussing personnel, real estate, investment of funds, and legal matters.
Second.
Motion's been made by Mr. Weaver, seconded by Mr. O'Brien. All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? Chair votes aye. Motion passes 5-0. We're now in closed session.
Mr. Weaver might be able to
read for us,
please, sir. Tony wants to do this himself. He comes.
He's not memorized.
He wants to memorize it all.
That's right.
He knows all these, and he can skip down.
Have enough time.
Yes.
For it.
Yes.
Give him a copy so he can start.
Mr. Chair, I move the closed meeting be adjourned, and the Fluvanna County Board of Supervisors convene again in open session. Be it resolved, the Board of Supervisors does hereby certify that, to the best of each member's knowledge, only public business matters lawfully exempted from open meeting requirements under Section 2.2-3711A-A of the Code of Virginia 1950 as amended, and only such public business matters as were identified in a motion by which the closed meeting was convened were heard, discussed, or considered in the meeting, a second and a recorded vote needed.
Second.
Motion's been made by Mr. Weaver, seconded by Ms. Booker. Mr. O'Brien?
Aye.
Ms. Booker?
Aye.
Mr. Weaver?
Ms.
Eager?
Aye.
Chair votes aye, 5-0.
Before I forget it.
Ms. Weaver?
I took it home one time.
Gosh, I said it again.
Oh.
But I was looking at Ms. Eager. That, somebody want to get us out of here?
Okay.
So, I moved to be adjourned.
Motion made by Ms. Booker, seconded by Mr. O'Brien. All in favor of adjourning?
Aye.
And
opposed?
Happy Mother's Day.
Happy Mother's Day.
Happy Mother's Day.